they didn't seem bad when I was out here. And then I came back and moved to Anchorage. And then a couple months later, I hear this on the news.
Murder charges against five Matsu Valley teenagers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 13th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans react to President-elect Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of State.
You're not going to find a finer company than Exxon, but they're tough negotiators.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
A group of Matanuska Valley teenagers ranging from 16 to 19 were arraigned in State Superior Court in Palmer today in the disturbing kidnap and murder case of another Valley teen, David Grunwald. As Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports, all five will be charged as adults.
Wearing prison yellow and linked together by chains, the five made their first court appearance Tuesday in Palmer.
We have Austin Barrett. And, Your Honor, again, the caption is correct.
Various attorneys for the five teens entered not guilty pleas while Judge Carrie Christensen set pretrial and trial dates for the defendants. No bail was set for four of the defendants. Those four, Eric Almendinger, 16, Bradley Renfro, 16, Dominic Johnson, also 16, and 19-year-old Austin Barrett, are charged with six counts of first- and second-degree murder, kidnapping, and hindering prosecution, among other charges. They will be tried together. The fifth teen, 18-year-old Devin Peterson, was indicted separately. Peterson is charged with three counts of evidence tampering and hindering prosecution and will be tried alone. Peterson's bail was set at $100,000. The case has sobered many residents of the rural Matanuska Valley. In November, high school student David Grunwald, also 16, was reported missing. His body was located December 2nd in woods along the Knik River. He had been shot to death, a medical examiner's report confirmed, but before that, he had been badly beaten. Almendinger was arrested on December 3rd. The other four defendants were taken in on December 9th. About the same time, hundreds had gathered at the Palmer Fairgrounds for a candlelight prayer vigil for the murdered Grunwald. Family and friends of both Grunwald and the defendants pressed into the courtroom Tuesday to witness the brief proceedings. Most declined to speak to the press, but Damian Peterson from Anchorage stepped forward.
Yeah, Devin's my little brother. It's a lot to take in right now. I don't think his bail should be $100K. That's crazy. He doesn't really have an involvement.
Devin Peterson has been charged with evidence tampering in relation to two guns incidental to the case and in allegedly destroying evidence, in this case Grunwald's Ford Bronco, which was found burned near Wasilla a day after the victim went missing. A grand jury indictment filed last week indicates at least four of the defendants, quote, knowingly engaged in conduct that resulted in the death of David Grunwald under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life. Almendinger's attorney, Hannah Thorsten Bowery, says not guilty pleas are standard for felony arraignments. Judge Christensen has set a January 13th pretrial conference date and a February 21st trial date for Almendinger, Johnson, Renfro, and Barrett. Peterson's pretrial hearing is set for January 20th, and his trial date is February 27th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Governor Bill Walker has undergone surgery to treat prostate cancer, and his office says no further treatment is currently expected. A release from Walker's office says Walker is recovering following a four-hour surgery on Monday. Walker called the surgery a success and said the outpouring of support he and his family have received since announcing his diagnosis last month has been humbling. He says he looks forward to returning to work soon. Walker's office is expected this week to release his budget proposal for the next fiscal year. President-elect Donald Trump has chosen ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as his nominee for Secretary of State. National attention has focused on Tillerson's close ties to Russia, but he and his company also have a long history in Alaska. Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
For the last few years, Rex Tillerson has perhaps been known best in Alaska for his public disagreements with Governor Bill Walker over efforts to build a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope.
I doubt the governor is going to be invited to any State Department formal dinners.
That's longtime industry observer Larry Persily. Exxon is the state's largest owner of natural gas reserves and was, until recently, the lead partner in the effort to build a gas line, a role the state is now taking over. Last year, Tillerson told World Gas Intelligence that Alaska has been its own, quote, worst enemy on the pipeline project, saying the state changes its approach every time it changes governors. Governor Walker has frequently fired back. And Exxon has feuded and negotiated with many Alaska governors over the gas pipeline, the development of the Point Thompson field, the value of the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and, of course, oil taxes. I asked State Senator Burt Stedman if Exxon under Tillerson was active in the state's perennial debates on the subject.
Oh, yes. Of course they are. All three major companies are.
Stedman, a Sitka Republican, is one of the legislature's top oil and gas experts. He says Exxon has its own style.
You know, Exxon has the Exxon culture. Very formal, very straightforward, and they're tough negotiators.
Stedman says he'd be pleased to have a cabinet member who's familiar with Alaska and with the Arctic, which Tillerson certainly is. Exxon's long history in the state also, of course, includes its most famous black eye, the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound in 1989. Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society says that history still lingers.
There's still a lot of concern in Alaska over 25 years after the Exxon Valdez tragedy, the spill. That Prince William Sound hasn't fully recovered, and that there was significant harm to the local economy.
Tillerson was CEO of Exxon in 2008 when the U.S. Supreme Court slashed punitive damages for the spill from $5 billion to $500 million, reducing the payout to many Alaskans. When it comes to another environmental issue of interest in Alaska, Exxon's track record on climate change under Tillerson is complicated. Last month, the company officially came out in support of the Paris Agreement to cut global carbon emissions. That makes Tillerson potentially the only one of Trump's nominees so far to publicly hold that position. And as Secretary of State, he would be one of the nation's top negotiators on international climate agreements, Epstein points out.
I do think the fact that ExxonMobil has endorsed the Paris Climate Agreement is a good thing. So at least in terms of climate change, we are cautiously hopeful with Mr. Tillerson, particularly compared to some of the other nominees for the cabinet.
But Exxon is also under fire from environmentalists after reporting raised questions about whether the company understood the science behind climate change for decades internally, while externally funding organizations that raise doubts about it. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Alaska's congressional delegation is largely unconcerned about President-elect Trump's criticism of the $400 billion F-35 fighter jet program. In a tweet yesterday, Trump called the program's costs out of control, adding, when he takes office, billions of dollars in military expenses will be saved. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Representative Don Young issued statements expressing confidence Trump will see the value of the F-35 program after Inauguration Day. A statement from Senator Dan Sullivan emphasized the tactical benefits of the F-35s, though he added Trump raises legitimate concerns over costs and delays. By 2022, Eielson Air Force Base is slated to host 54 F-35s, bringing an additional 2,500 personnel and up to $500 million in new construction. It's not clear what prompted Trump to tweet about the F-35 on Monday. However, that morning, several national news outlets reported President Obama's defense secretary was in Israel for a ceremony to mark the delivery of that country's first F-35. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the scary lessons of walking on thin ice.
And she said, I realized that I have done something that I was not supposed to, and I will never do that again and put people in danger.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority will undergo a special audit. The Legislative Budget and Audit Committee voted in favor of the action today. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has been covering the trust. Ann, how did the meeting go?
The meeting was actually really quick. There wasn't a big discussion about it. Mike Hawker brought forward the idea of doing the special audit. He said that he has been speaking to some folks over at the trust who are looking into the concerns of the public, but ultimately they voted unanimously to have a special audit.
What will the audit do?
So what the audit will do, it's going to look into the trust's investments and their asset management, because lawmakers want to know if the trust's board and employees are actually complying with the statutes. So that means looking into things like, should they actually be putting the money into the permanent fund instead of investing on their own? Because statute says that. But other admin codes say that they can do things like have a development account, or they need to diversify their assets. So it's looking into the legality of what they're doing.
Does the trust have a yearly audit?
They do. The question becomes, what's part of that yearly audit? So at the moment, the trust land office, it has been buying real estate. $39 million worth of real estate. And every piece of property that they buy is put into its own LLC, its own limited liability company. And the question is are those LLCs looked at individually in this audit? And the Trust Land Office, your executive director says, yes, they're part of the audit. But the chief financial officer says, no, they aren't part of this audit. And back in 2015, he suggested that they have an audit policy similar to the Permanent Fund Corporation, and the board decided not to do that.
So what is the Trust Land Office investing in?
The trust is primarily investing in things like real estate, like office buildings that already have tenants in it, and some light industrial areas. Like I said, they've already got $39 million in real estate. They say that they're getting about a 15% return on their investments. It's important to note that there is no cap on the amount of money they can spend to buy new real estate or enter into new ventures. In fact, the board voted earlier this year that the Trust Land Office should be investing enough to quadruple the amount of revenue they're bringing in right now.
How will they do that?
The plan is still in the works. That hasn't been released yet. It does include things like entering into joint ventures. So, for example, back in May, they voted to spend up to $11 million on a joint venture to develop a dock warehouse in Washington. The resource management plan says that that is the riskiest kind of investment they can make, but it also has a high level of potential return.
And the legislative audit also includes a look at potential Open Meetings Act violations. Tell us about that.
So that's been discussed a lot lately. There's been some accusations of potential violations back in like November and October. One thing that rises to the surface is the executive committee as a whole, all three members, sent an email to a trust staff member asking her to hire an attorney and not tell any other members of the board and not tell any other members of staff. And they did not publicly notice that they would be taking action or communicating as a group. So Open Meetings Act does apply to executive committee. Is this a violation? I don't know, because I'm not a lawyer. But it's one of the things that has raised concern.
Is it known how long the audit may take?
Could take months. It just depends on what they find.
All right, Ann, thanks for that update.
Thanks.
Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has been covering the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Bernie Carl and his business K&K Recycling have kept a variety of materials out of Fairbanks landfill since the 1980s. But recent years' weak markets and high costs have forced downsizing of the operation. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Lack of a market for recycled materials and products has driven K&K to stop collecting paper and glass. The company, which several years ago halted plastic recycling, announced the decision last week. K&K President Bernie Carl says they've been losing money on recycling.
We have not made one dime recycling cardboard, paper, plastic, glass, or wood. We have spent several million dollars, and we have not one thing to show for it except a lot of grief.
Carl says K&K, which collects recyclables at local military bases and the University of Alaska Fairbanks, has been losing $20,000 a month on paper and glass. He says metal, which K&K will continue to take, is the only profitable item the company collects, noting there's no local demand for K&K's primary recycled product.
We make three different kinds of fuel products now out of cardboard, paper, and plastic. Haven't been able to sell any of it.
That's in part due to the failure of an experimental power plant K&K built with United Technologies to burn the paper fuel and lack of interest from local coal-fired power plant operators like the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
We're talking a long lead time to get anything up and running.
UAF Director of Environmental Health, Safety, and Risk Management Francis Isgrig says burning the recycled paper fuel raises permitting issues.
Permit that is going to take a little bit of time and a little bit of energy, and there would need to be some source testing done to make sure that we meet all of the strict requirements under hazardous air pollutants before we could even burn this type of fuel in the boiler.
UAF will transition to a new coal-fired power plant unit in 2 years, and University Associate Vice Chancellor for Facility Services Scott Bell says burning the recycled paper pellet fuel requires equipment that's not in the budget.
The new boilers, we ran into some real cost overruns and solved that by cutting about $40 million out of the project, and part of what we cut was material handling for the biomass. But if we could come up with a long-term contract for biomass, then part of that could be cover the cost of installing the material handling equipment for pellets.
Bell says the university is focused on bringing the new plant online with coal before looking at alternative fuels.
But you know, we've certainly left the door open with K&K to discuss that as a possibility, their pellets as a possibility in the future.
Bell says burn and emissions testing needs to be done on the recycled paper fuel before any supply contract is considered. K&K's Carl says he does not have support from his employee-owned company to pay for the research, but is hoping to find a private partner, emphasizing too much has gone into the project to give up.
Our equipment's not going anywhere. We have $4 million invested just in pelletizing equipment. We went out and bought a brand new briquetter. I'm going to find a market for them eventually.
Carl says there's also potential to produce building bricks from the recycled materials and that he plans to put up some structures with them next year. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at AlaskaQuitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Winter months are an especially dangerous time for the homeless. KTOO's Quentin Chandler reports the cold means people who sleep outdoors in low temperatures are at risk of sickness and death.
It's cold in Juneau. Earlier this month, the city saw one of its heaviest snowfalls in at least a couple of years. And according to the National Weather Service, temperatures ranged between the teens and the mid-20s. Carly Phillips was sleeping outside.
Oh my gosh, so that storm, we were actually sleeping way under a dock and it just got drenched. And this is like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. We're soaking wet, shivering, and just everything just gushing water.
Phillips is homeless, and she regularly comes to one of Juneau's few homeless shelters called the Glory Hole to get warm and to get food. She says that night, she didn't even go to sleep.
So I ended up just shivering in a doorway under some sheets I found. I feel bad because I think I took them from somebody, but I didn't sleep that night because I was afraid I would die.
Turn on that.
Yeah.
Rose Lawhorn says if you're sleeping outside on a night like Phillips just described, dying isn't far-fetched.
Weather and temperatures down around zero or in the teens like we've had them, or with lots of snow or wind, even damp clothes really contributes to life-threatening hypothermia.
Lawhorn is a nurse and supervisor in the emergency department at Bartlett Regional Hospital. She says during winter, homeless people can get hit hard.
More affected, colder, more illness during the winter months. We'll start seeing them multiple times in a day, hungry and cold, and just looking for a way to get out of the elements.
Lawhorn doesn't know how many people come into the ER for exposure because those cases aren't always captured in the hospital's records.
But what I can tell you is we get many patients every day who are brought to us by either Rainforest Recovery, they walk in themselves, they're brought by friends or family who are concerned, or JPD brings them to us, and that is multiple times per day.
Lawhorn says the range in conditions is huge. Some people are just cold and hungry, and some are literally freezing to death. At the Glory Hole, Executive Director Maria Lovishuk says the shelter has 40 beds for overnighters, and during the winter, they're usually over capacity.
We don't turn anybody away for the lack of beds. So last night we had 46 people sleeping here. So if you don't have enough beds, they put people on the floor.
Lovishuk says they give breathalyzer tests every night, so people who have a blood alcohol level over 0.1 aren't allowed in. People can also be suspended for longer periods.
When people commit violent offenses or exhibit behavior that is really threatening towards other patrons or staff, they do get suspended from here. And then I think we have two or three people who cannot get any services here.
She says the Glory Hole is the only short-term shelter that takes men, women, and children in Juneau. So unless suspended people and people who choose not to sleep in the dorms have somewhere else to go, they'll end up outside. Phillips chooses not to sleep in the shelter.
I actually haven't gotten sick from sleeping outside. I've gotten sick from sleeping in here.
Phillips claims the dorms have poor air quality and are overcrowded.
And also body odor issues. People don't regularly bathe or wash themselves.
Another person said they didn't sleep in the shelter because they kept getting into fights. And being outside was easier, even though it's clearly dangerous. Phillips and others said when they're outside, they have to wear a lot of layers and sleep under multiple blankets, sleeping bags, and comforters, anything to stay warm. Recently, there was a rumor that a homeless man died sleeping on the street. An officer in the Juneau Police Department has said it's just a rumor. Lovishuk says she spent 3 hours trying to confirm it, and now also thinks it's just a rumor. But she says it definitely could happen. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center officials warn every winter about the perils of walking across the lake ice. On Sunday, that warning hit home when one Juneau man fell into the frigid water looking out for an adventurous grandmother standing on thin ice. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
Like many others over the weekend, Yana White was hiking across the apparently frozen Mendenhall Lake toward the face of the glacier. She was with her daughter and her mother.
It was very sunny and beautiful, and my mom just came over for 6 months to stay with us. She came from Russia, and she just wanted to see and touch and feel the glacier.
It had been cold for days, but she says as they got close to the face, she noticed the ice getting thinner. Some puddles were visible, too.
And my mom felt a little adventurous. She refused to turn back, and she kept walking and walking towards the glacier. So I stopped because I had my daughter with me.
White and her daughter turned back. Another hiker's photo shows White's mom standing awkwardly, perhaps 20 yards from a section of deep blue, freshly calved glacier. White says her mom was scared. Houston Laws of Juneau is in the foreground of that photo, another 25 yards or so back from White's mom. Laws says he knows to stay away from the face of the glacier where the ice is thinnest because water is flowing below. He was keeping his dogs in check, but he says he didn't see any indication the ice was thin, and there were more tracks in the snow in front of him. Moments after the photo was snapped, he was in the drink.
And I probably took two steps and I fell in. No fast completion or anything. It was just like a slow elevator speed up to my chest. It was like standing on a coffee table.
For most of us, that coffee table elevator ride would trigger panic. But Laws, who's well known as an ultra runner, isn't most people. He's actually trained for this kind of thing.
It was kind of like, this sucks, but like, what's the next step? I want to get out of here, and I can't feel, I can't toe off, I can't lift off, I can't toe off. There's no bottom underneath me, so I paddled this to the side. Just thinking about the next step was helpful from my past training.
White says that calmness, yeah, it's legit.
He got out of the water really quickly. He was just, you know, he looked so calm and so cool, and it kind of made me think that he has been through that before.
Law says he hadn't, besides in a training scenario. He rolled himself onto more solid ice, then saw White's mom walking toward the hole he'd just made. She doesn't speak English, so White translated for Laws, who steered her back to safety.
When I finally reunited with my mother, she just said, "Oh my gosh, Yana, thank you so much." And I said, "Well, you need to thank that young man." And yes, she turned around and she said, "Thank you," in her broken English. But later at home, she just said, "Yana, I have never felt so much adrenaline in my life. And that was the first time." And she said, "I realized that I have done something that I was not supposed to. And I will never do that again and put people in danger."
Law says he was very cold, wet, and embarrassed. Initially, he didn't want to talk about it, but his hiking partner cajoled him into warning others on their hike back and sharing the story. Laws had seen other photos people had shared under what appear to be identical conditions taken the day before his misadventure.
And it's like identical, the location, the exact location of people's selfies are just right where I fell in. And it was just a day apart.
It's a lesson Laws, White, and Glacier Visitor Center officials want everyone to learn, but not firsthand. Laws says he's fine, and all his digits are intact. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Lori Craig, lead naturalist at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, says the terminus of the glacier has been very active lately. She strongly discourages walking on the ice. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Rachel Waldholtz, Zachariah Hughes, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Jeremy Shea, and Quentin Chandler in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein. Online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.